But
I remember that trip rather well. I remember the certain aspects about the Hopi snake dance. Certain writers have written, and it has been proven that the fangs have been removed from some of the rattlesnakes that they dance, the Indians dance with, holding these snakes in their mouths. Of course, it's always been a great fascination as to how do they do this without getting killed. But my father and I saw one snake open its mouth, and we saw the fangs and the sheath. There's a kind of a fleshy sheath behind the fangs, which is quite visible when the fangs are extended. And we saw this very clearly. I remember it as if it were yesterday. And this is 1931. I was able to go back to the snake dance again in 33. He only saw it once. Second time, when he was unable to go, he gave me a list as long as your arm of questions to observe, because he wanted all the information I could possibly get. And of course, I wanted to help him. I was a youngster then of about 17, and in the way that he always did, I had a notebook in which I took very thorough notes of my observations. After the dance was over and the crowd was generally dispersing, the Indians had gone down off of the mesa onto the flatlands to release the snakes and had come back. They're still in costumes, and one of them was preparing to enter a kiva, as they call it, probably to disrobe. I think the religious ceremony was finished, I'm not sure. And he saw me writing. It had no camera, of course, because cameras by then were forbidden. But I was writing, and that was believed to be sacrilegious to their ceremonies, which were very, very serious to them. The whole snake dance is a...
Did he take it away from you?
Yeah, he took it away from me and threw it down in the kiva, and so all my note-taking was to no avail. And my father insisted that when I got home, I write to the agent of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the United States government, at the Hopi Reservation, and see if he could get it back for me. And I guess I did write to that fellow, but I never got it back.
That's an interesting story. I wanted to ask you also on the on his two-volume work that was published in 1956 on rattlesnakes. When did he conceive the idea of writing a book of this length?
Well, I remember about the time it started, because I remember him saying, "Well, I'm going to write a book about rattlesnakes." And that means that I'm home weekends. No parties, no nothing.
Do you recall when that was? Do you recall?
And I know it took 11 years to accomplish the book, so that was in the 40s.
In 45. That's interesting.
He was so tremendously thorough about things. That's one of the adjectives the reviewers use, and we're still getting book reviews. The press sends them to my mother whenever they receive one. They send her a Xerox. And I, of course, had observed this all the time I was living here in the home, but also after his death, when I was helping to put together the finishing touches on the second edition, we'd find two or three drafts of the same chapter, which were typed triple space, and then he would write on them his changes. And of course, he knew which was the latest draft, but we didn't know which was the latest draft, and we'd have to figure this out.
Another nice compliment. They still pay his book. I've had a copy sent to me from University of California Press of this last recent miniature publication they've gotten out. if you've seen that one.
I have not seen it, no.
It's there on the shelf by the window. And we're praying. Two or three comments on these reviews that have been made, and there are many came, even though of this small book, referred to his original copy, his original volumes, as a herpetologist Bible. And what surprised me about it was that not only very much of a compliment, but the fact that several reviewers said the same thing. It's on that upper shelf. I'll better get it.
Abridged edition, perhaps. She told you when I was out of the room, the University of California Press had the idea that there might be a sale for a greatly shortened and simplified edition with a lot of the material deleted that's of interest chiefly to scientists. So they put this together, and this was published, so what year did it come out? Does it have a date?
82.
82. Karen McClung is the abridger, and
she took a great interest in it and wanted to do it.
So inasmuch as it was published in 82, which is very recent, my mother is still receiving a number of reviews of this book published in various scientific publications here and there. Zunews reviewed it about a year and a half ago. Curiously enough, neither the Evening Tribune nor the San Diego Union nor any other publication in San Diego except Zunews has printed a review of this book, even though it's by a native San Diegan. Most of the reviews say that the abridger has done a fine job of preserving the original wit and sparkle of my father's writing.
The style of writing.
And that's a great tribute to her.
It is. As I'm leafing through this, I see a chapter on Indians and rattlesnakes. That's what you were speaking of earlier.
The reviews also point out that it omits a chapter about the treatment of snake bite. And that is intentional because, of course, scientific writing about the treatment of snake bite is a very serious matter. And my father never considered him himself an expert from a medical point of view, although he had provided a lot of information and a lot of material to physicians. They, inasmuch as the technology improves every year, and inasmuch as 14 years had gone by since his death, well, it is obvious that the science of treatment of snake bite is advanced after he left it. And so they did not wish to put anything in there which might be looked upon as authoritarian, and I think that's a very good decision. The world expert on snake bite is Dr. Findlay Russell of Los Angeles, who was in a laboratory at the University of Southern California. And he and my father were fast friends and had a very great admiration for each other.
Many consultations.
Many letters from him.
He would come down here with letters often, too. But they had many meetings and working together and writing.
Well, Dr. Russell wrote a book which was published about 2 years ago, which is the definitive work on venomous snake bites. And of course, there are many, many passages ascribed to my father in there.
I wanted to ask you both about the contacts that your husband, your father had in the scientific world. You've already spoken.
Well, I think that one amusing aspect of that, the scientists, whenever they would visit San Diego, as I said earlier, would link up with my father. They wanted to work in his laboratory to study his specimens, and they wanted to talk with him. Well, he'd go to work all day, and they'd be in the laboratory here all day. They hit a kind of a personality pattern to me. I want to see whether you corroborate this. They're mostly introverted people, very quiet, very knowledgeable in their own field, but not very worldly in other fields. And they also don't make much money, so they don't dress very fancily. And I remember from time to time there'd be one whose car would be parked out in front. It was a pretty shabby car, and junk all throughout the back seat. They tend to be untidy also, these scientists. My father was very tidy, but his colleagues in the profession were not. You remember some of those?
Oh, yes, I remember very many of them. But I think it was still his own personality. In a way, he was a sort of introvert, but through his business activities, I think a good deal of that was covered up. But so I think he knew how to meet these people, and he knew how to draw them out, just because of his own tendency along that line.
That's interesting. I wanted to ask you both, do you think if he had the opportunity early in his career to become a full-time career hepatologist, if he had that opportunity, do you think he would have taken it rather than pursuing this in the fashion he did and going into the business world?
I think he liked doing the unusual thing. I mean, and it was, as a youngster, early childhood pictures of him dangling in a little snake. And I think there's, I don't know whether it was how he met Dr. Wagerfirth or just how it came about, but this. The story just got to me and other friends. Well, Lawrence Clover was the only man he knew that wasn't afraid of it. Used to like to play with snakes as a child and liked them. And there are people. I have a friend out at Rancho Santa Fe right now who likes them. They want to do that.
But do you think he would have, if he did have the opportunity?
And he liked doing the unusual, don't you think?
Yes, it's a very good question, and curiously, I don't remember it's ever having been asked before, and I don't really know. He was a very practical, pragmatic kind of a man, and you can obviously make a better living in the business world if you had the talents that he had. Whether he would have decided were that opportunity presented to him, well, I got to make a living over here. I better do this herpetology as a sideline, as an avocation. Mm-hmm. He might have decided it that way, but on the other hand, he obviously was a success in the business world, which means that he did not slight his duties and responsibilities in the business world. Something very unusual happened to him, which corroborates my statement. The company has long had a policy that you retire at age 65. And now, of course, the federal laws have been enacted that that's unlawful, but that's a much later era. When he reached 65, they respected his abilities and his wisdom so much that the board of directors invited him to stay 5 more years as chief executive of the gas and electric company. And it was a difficult decision for him because he had made his personal plans to retire at age 65, and more than that, there had been a lot of people who wanted to stay beyond age 65, and he was the man who had to tell them that they could not. Mm-hmm. And here the board invited him to do so, And he finally decided that he would.
As a consultant?
No, he stayed as chief executive until age 70, and then retired. You retire on the first of the month, next following your 70th birthday, in his case. Well, that is to say that despite the great amount of time that he put in this labor of love of his hobby, snakes and lizards, he could not have slighted his responsibility and his vocation, or they wouldn't have invited him to do that. So he did have a liking for his work, or he would not have succeeded in it to the degree that he did.
Well, there is a story, though, that involves the man who took a great interest in him, who was manager of the San Diego Gas and Electric when he started his employment there, and that was Mr. Jones. And they became rather friends, as much as, I guess, the highest official could with an employee. Because they were also, he was also a friend of a brother, so it made it a little more personal. But they had some talks, and I do remember telling me how that Mr. Jones had said, "You've got to have a hobby." And he tried to figure out what the hobby would be. And I think he really did consider it a hobby. Whether it should be an active one, well, then he found out he couldn't be too active. It wasn't physically able to be, like golf or tennis or whatever. What particularly happened, that it happened to be reptiles, I really am not sure. But I do remember that just dwelling on the fact several times that Mr. Jones said, "You must have a hobby."
And with his lifelong interest in snakes, that it was sort of natural that he would go into this.
Well, he tried a few other things as hobbies earlier than this. For example, he got into woodworking tools. And the tools are no longer here because we've disposed of them, but...
Well, he liked owning the tools. He didn't do very much with it.
It was a very impressive tool room.
Oh, he just loved the tools. He obtained everything. He never did much with it.
Were there any other hobbies that he pursued?
Well, he always liked to play poker, and he liked the mathematical aspects of poker, and he wrote
games of chance.
Mm-hmm. Wrote a little book about the mathematical chances of drawing various poker hands before the draw and after the draw.
I wanted to ask you also, both of you, with his reputation as a scholar in the field, did he lecture at universities? Was he invited to? I mean, a guest lecture?
No, he didn't, but he was asked to give a number of talks in San Diego. He became very much interested in the atom when that came out. And he studied it and worked it out and developed it in his own thinking and figuring, understanding it. And he gave a number of talks on the atom.
Well, that became a kind of a second hobby to him, particularly after his retirement, but it was already apparent before his retirement. He would study up on a certain subject and give a talk on it to the Rotary Club or to the Wednesday Club or to a class at San Diego State. But oftentimes these were about reptiles, but more often than not, they were on other subjects. My mother mentions the atomic bomb when it first came out from under the security in 45. He got fascinated with that and made talks about atomic energy and how it works. And he had a great ability at explaining scientific things for a layman's mind. And that talk he gave more than any other because it was wanted by so many, many groups. But later in life, he gave talks
on the population?
Yeah, the population explosion. And another one was about the life of Charles Darwin.
Oh, yes, very much interested in that.
And another one was the life of Pliny, who was a Roman scientist, and he did this in a way that's different from most people. Most people will take their notes on a single piece of paper, or maybe will write their paper up in a way that can be handed to someone afterward, and you've got a copy of the paper. Well, once in a while, he would have his typed up in that form, but for his own use, he would write little notes on pieces of 3x5 paper, not cards, but little pieces of paper. And he could rearrange these as he was planning the talk and might decide something goes in a different sequence better. So if you've got them on little pieces of paper, you could rearrange them. And we still have a lot of those talks which have never been written up in text, but comprise these notes of a pile of papers about 3/4 of an inch thick with a rubber band around
it. That's interesting.
Another thing he did, he was very clever at writing poetry, and particularly after he retired and had more time, he saw that it was healthful to diversify his activities a little bit. When someone would have a birthday or a wedding anniversary or a new child or new grandchild would be born, he'd write a poem. And we have a collection of all of those. It's really quite a marvelous insight into his wit.
Yeah, Mr. Marston, George Marston, had kind of amusing and interesting correspondence in poetry at one time for their birthdays.
Tell them about Belle Benchley's retirement.
And of course, when Miss Benchley was retiring, she was given a trip around the world to visit various zoos, you may know. And it was very amusing because here was this long table of people and everybody was giving nice little talks. Finally came his turn. I believe he was president or at the zoo at the time. And maybe he followed her. Anyway, he was an official up there at this table. And he starts in and he hauls out something that looked like a railroad ticket. If you remember the old days, because she was going largely by train. I don't think she was doing much flying. And he hauled out and held it up to this audience of a railroad ticket, a series of all the places she was going to go. And of course the audience just roared, laughing. And with that, he reads a poem applying to all these places on the tickets, the series of where she would be. And it caused great amusement. We still have a record of that. It was fun to have. Certainly a lot of fun to hear.
Was the Altruista Society or one of those local women's groups?
Yes, a group of women now, who was that, just recently met over there at the park and invited me. I'm sorry, I don't remember just their title. And it's just sort of a local group of women who are in the business world, I think. I've forgotten their title. And I was invited, and Philip was too, and they asked us for this ticket. Somebody had told them, in some way or other, they knew about that particular evening of Miss Benchley's. They had given a bench in her name to the zoo. It's on one of their little platforms there where you mount and go up the steps and can sit down and look around at these various specimens there, and in her name. So they wanted to dedicate that, and they had a nice dinner before. And they read this poem off that evening, appropriate to that time that she, when she left, departed on her trip.
It's fascinating.
Because she had been a member of that
club. Yes, she had. Yes, the women in business, and I'm just not sure what their title is now.
Do you have to leave, Mr. Fowler, or can we?
I'm going to leave when my record runs out, okay. Here, which is pretty soon.
Okay. See, if I want to do. I wanted to ask you also, as a scholar, who were some of the people who
corresponded with. I mean, there were a number of people who visited here, and who were some of the people internationally who corresponded with?
Well, in his field, a few names come to me. I've mentioned Dr. Vandenberg and Mr. Slevin from the California Academy of Sciences. I've mentioned Dr. Findlay Russell at USC, who was somewhat later. There was a Charles M. Bogert, who was with the American Museum of Natural History.
New York.
They were in New York. They were very close friends. There was a Doris Cochran in Minneapolis, who tended to specialize in rattlesnakes. There was a Dr. Edward H. Taylor at the University of Kansas. Remember him?
No, no.
From time to time, I'll happen to stumble across a scientific writing of some kind, and all these names are great names in the herpetology field. Charles M. Burt, B-U-R-T, at University of Utah. Hobart Smith. Alexander Ruthven was the president of the University of Michigan, and he had come up through the zoology faculty. So he became quite prominent in education circles. Of course, I helped also at 25 cents an hour in the cataloging of the library. My father kept a very meticulous card catalog of all of his library holdings, and they were filed by the name of the author. And so all of these names are prominent in my memory as having been authors. H.K. Gloyd was also at the University of Michigan. And there was that fat fellow at the Field Museum in Chicago, Carl Patterson Schmidt.
Yeah, somebody in Chicago.
And somebody in St. Louis, I think, too.
Oh, yeah, Marlon Perkins, who later became prominent on television.
Yes, he had some correspondence.
It was not in the very scholarly end of reptiles, but more the exhibiting end. I guess he's still prominent today and puts on a TV show from time to time.
Still pictured.
Sherman Minton, who was the son of a United States senator, was prominent in University of Indiana. And then there was a fellow named Wooden, W-O-O-D-I-N, who was one of the very early people in the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum in Tucson. And he was a son of the early Secretary of the Treasury.
What became of all the
Frenchmen? Well, some of them are still alive. I saw Minton referred to just the other day.
Files now at the museum?
The card catalog
and the correspondence files of those?
How about the letters? Where are they?
The museum has most of that.
I wanted to ask you also, did Lawrence Klaver travel to zoos and as a consultant for our zoo here, and did he interact with some of the other curators?
Usually he would travel on business and take a few hours off in New York or Chicago or Washington, D.C., or much more frequently in San Francisco and Los Angeles. He was not really a widely traveled man, despite his interest in foreign lands and great knowledge of foreign countries. He never has been outside of North America. He's never gone farther south than San Quintin in Mexico. There was tremendous interest in the animals from Mexico, but he never went very far into Mexico. I suppose that can be explained in a number of ways. One, he had too much absorbing him here during his working career. He had his work and he rarely took a vacation. After he retired, he had his book that he was working on, and there was more of that than he could ever get done in the amount of time available to him. And he didn't like to fly. He was subject to air sickness.
Early flying time, because he was very sensitive, and for some reason or other, being seasick, he wouldn't get on the boat. And I have seen him when he was seasick, not knowing that was going to be that kind of an experience that developed anyway. And he would be seasick and was ill for a week afterward from the experience. And it happened twice, and at once. Planes would drop with air. They had air pocket. They didn't have fly high enough, I guess, to avoid the air pocket. And they hit air pockets a couple of times. He was desperately ill for it. And he was ill for a whole week afterward.
It was funny what Mother Nature will do. I was a Boy Scout, and my troop planned an expedition one Saturday to the Coronado Islands. There's only one way to get there, is by boat. And you go in a little boat, and he wanted to hunt snakes and lizards down there. He's very curious as to what occurred there. And he wanted to go badly enough that he went along with us. And it wasn't a terribly stormy day, but if you've ever been out there, you know it's kind of rough even on the best of days. But he did all right, and he climbed all over that island because his mind was diverted away from the seasickness by this great interest in hunting there.
Well, the next time we went, the second time I saw him seasick, was going down there on this trip. Friends were only going to take us out in the bay. So that they start off on the ocean. And they started to the Coronado Islands. And he was desperately ill that day.
And Mr. Clauber, this has been a delightful interview for me. They've been very informative.
She knows more than I do. But he did have more experiences with him because he went with him quite often. I had to stay home. But I made many night trips with him. Kept the blank book and listed with the DORs.
Well, thank you both.
You're welcome.